what we're saying about Furman, right?
Yeah.
If the there's this kind of fascination with the collapse of the Soviet Union because we feel we're going down the fucking pan ourselves, right? If we are, or there's something analogous happening, then who is going to be the person who comes to rescue us from it, right? Because that's what Putin did.
Right. Yeah, so who's the Caesar?
Who's the Putin? Yeah, well, but it's not. It's a shitty version, right? So,
well, but all other versions of Caesar are shitty relative to Caesar, duh.
Well, that is also true.
All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to BungaCast, the global politics podcast at the end of history. A special hello to those, I don't know, 14% of listeners who find themselves in the early days of the exact same nation as they were in last week, which is to say the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland.
A worse nation.
It's just the same. Well, we're going to get into this. Let's not prejudge the discussion. I'm Alex Hochuli in São Paulo, Brazil, the other two members of BungaCast, George Hoare and Philip Cunliffe, are in that United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and therefore can bring to bear their insights on what just happened in the UK's general election. Hi, boys.
Hey. Hi. We can indeed. So it's actually 66 or maybe 67% even of this podcast is based in the UK. So we have that regional expertise.
Spiritually, we're all still here, as we've constantly made plain to Alex over the years.
Well, I'm definitely feeling a bit chilly here. So, you know, maybe that's the transmission of that characteristic British chilliness in moral and personality terms, obviously, not just the weather. Anyway, did you guys stay up and watch the result? Did you on tenterhooks, as people say? Was there a scent of revolution in the air as you went to cast your ballots dutifully for the Labour Party?
Tenterhooks rather than tender hooks. People sometimes say on tender hooks, but it's not. It's called.
I kind of like that tender hooks.
Did not stay up all night. Did not. I don't think there were many people going to kind of exit poll parties. I don't think there were people, raving long into the night to stay up for the glorious Starmerite victory. And no, at least in my part of Northeast London, there was no scent of revolution in the air. I don't think people were particularly fired up about it. There was not people discussing it in pubs and arguing and kind of, you know, all this sort of thing.
Definitely not. And just so listeners are reassured, it's not just George and myself and our distinct lack of enthusiasm for the new regime, but also borne out by the voting numbers, like a shockingly low voter turnout. And collectively, the two major parties, Labour and Tories, have the lowest vote share since the start of the 20th century. And in some places, I mean, like really, some constituencies, like really low, like, you know, 50% low. And that is, remember, that's not a by-election. That would be kind of 50% turnout would be something similar to what you'd expect at a by-election during a term, you know, during the term of a government. A competitive election after 14 years of one party's rule, and to get in some constituencies just barely 50% scrape turnout, that's really saying something.
Yeah, but that's a very ballot box half empty perspective rather than a ballot box half full perspective. I mean, at least they managed to get 50% in some of those constituencies. I think that was probably higher than maybe I might have expected it to be given the options on offer. And
well, so like something like 9.7 million voted for Labour, the winner, and the party that got the largest vote share. You can contrast that with those who voted for no one at all, which is 19 million, right? So more than double.
Proud no one here.
No, Phil, you are
someone. We always thought you're a proud no one.
We believe in you.
I'm humble. Like, I make no bones about it. It's fine. So I'm happy to be accepted as part of the anonymous masses who withdrew their support from the governing regime.
So you identify yourself as the anonymous mass. It's in singular. No, I mean, yeah, same here. So I think we can speak on behalf of the silent majority.
So one thing
on the rare occasion.
So one thing, just observing this from afar and just looking at kind of the headlines, you guys can provide much more richness of detail. But it seemed that it was maybe counter to my expectations. What you had is a landslide for Labour, right? But already the headlines by the following day were already pointing out that, look, Labour got the largest share of votes, but they got the number of seats they got was hugely in excess of that. Indeed, around double the number of seats relative to, you know, the proportionality of the number, the votes they got, and that this was already a headline. So it was already a headline that, look, the Tories lost, Labour didn't win. And I was surprised by that because generally a lot of British media tends to be pretty affirmative and just goes, yay, new government, good for them. They swung in and got a big victory. And it was already putting kind of the dampeners for very objective and clear reasons, but, you know, putting the dampeners on that election result.
No, there is some, I mean, there is some of that. So, I mean, you know, as you might expect, predictably, say, in the editorial of The Observer, the Guardian sister newspaper on Sunday, you know, the tribute to the potential for renewal is fulsome. Some social media accounts, the very kind of strongly pro kind of Romanian Twitter accounts are doing some of that. But
that's,
you're right.
Pro-Romain, not pro-Romanian as the country.
Romanian, I said. But yes, I mean, you're right. It is remarkable that you have the discrepancy between the number of seats that Labour has won and the actual number of votes that they achieved has been drawn attention to insistently, in a way that I think is partly a reflection of social media, because you can share that chart very easily and it can kind of sweep through public debate. You know, the chart that shows kind of the difference between the two figures, you can show that very quickly in a way that I think would be more difficult in times past, right? Because you'd have to wait for it a few days later, it would turn up on the pages of your newspaper. And unless you were reading all the newspapers and, I don't know, clipping them and photocopying it and sending it to all your friends and family, right? There would be no way to rapidly impress upon such a wide number of people that overwhelming fact about the election. So I think it is partly in a, you know, kind of a function of the fact that you have so much political debate on social media. And also, I think even more importantly than that, there is a real consciousness among opinion forming elites and also informed citizens of the shabbiness, I suppose, and the decrepitude of the first past the post system. And I think that is very present in the debate in a way that I've not seen in my adult life. Even when there was a referendum on a form of PR, the alternative or alternative vote system some years back, which had been pushed by the Liberal Democrats. You know, I don't remember such kind of serious engagement with the problems of a distinctive electoral system then as I do now. I mean, maybe that was my lack of interest in the question of the time, but I think that would be a right adequate characterization.
I think so. And I mean, at the time, AV was alternative vote was kind of a technocratic solution, and so it was, you know, put forward in a very wonkish way. But now it's like the numbers are quite plain and striking. And just to kind of illustrate a point that Phil made about like the Labour and Tories getting a really low proportion of the vote together, only 58%, and previously it was, you know, up around 80, so like 76% in 2017 and 82% in 2019. But yeah, so you now have the situation where Reform get 4 million votes but only 5 seats, and you know, and then the Lib Dems get 3.5 million votes and 72 seats. So it's so, because there is the reality of, you know, that broadening out beyond Labour and the Tories, it, you know, people have to recognise it. I think another fact or another kind of aspect of the, you know, why was already there not very kind of sweeping kind of like in contrast to when Tony Blair won in 1997, why were people not blaring out D-Ream and kind of, you know, front pages of newspapers? You know, we're basically a whole new country now. It's because Starmer and the Labour Party had been pretty keen to kind of manage expectations, as I think they might put it. You know, we're not gonna say anything that we can't do in our manifesto. You know, don't expect too much from us. You know, don't get carried away. So I think it's all these things feed in, and that's why it doesn't feel like we've turned the page as a nation necessarily. Although it was an Independence Day vote. So on 4th of July, but it didn't really kind of probably amount to as much as it might have done in America.
And a vote for, you know, in the vassal state for its own dependence on the day of the independence of its former colony. It's kind of neat. Don't you think?
Yeah.
Anyway, so this was obviously a landslide which disguised a turn and the emergence of what seems to be a multi-party system, which is only held back from its full I don't know if flourishing is the right word, but it being manifest in Parliament by the fact that you have this first post the past system, which I'm not a fan of, but you know, its positive side is that when you have two main parties who dominate a large share of the vote, it throws up real workable majorities. And now you have a real workable majority, but with no substance behind it, with Labour having two-thirds of the seats, but only one-third a share of the vote. So this does suggest that this is a landslide that some people have been calling it like a sandcastle majority. And so this is contained within itself, the seeds of its own collapse. How flimsy do you think the kind of Labour Party's majority actually is, or the government will be?
I mean, I think this is sort of in some ways the central point of of this, that it's a hollow victory, lots of seats but lacking votes, you know, second lowest electoral turnout since 1885, not very much enthusiasm. So I think it's going to be interesting, because the idea of like having a, like, what does a mandate actually mean? Is a mandate means you have lots of seats and a working majority and you can get things done? Does it mean that you have a popular base of support that you can kind of mobilize and that are behind your kind of positive political program? Well, I think we'll sort of see. But I think this is it's one of the themes that's come out, I think, of amongst a lot of commentators, that it is a kind of a hollow victory, as much as you know, there are a lot of seats. You know, 412 is not to be sniffed at, but you know, is it really the sort of where we look back on this as a turning point in terms of, you know, maybe in the way that Blairism started in 97, that seems a little bit less likely.
So I mean, what do you think actually drove the wide distribution of votes across a much larger number of parties than in past elections?
Yeah, I mean, I think the...
We'll get into like the votes for specific parties and the pros and the cons, but just as a general observation, you've got votes sprayed around all sorts of different parties in a way that hasn't been the case before.
So, I mean, obviously the rise of Reform is one part of it. I said 4 million votes. That's, you know, that's pretty good going from a standing start, but I think it's more.
Yeah. So Reform, just to clarify for listeners, so Reform is Nigel Farage's party, who's the man who led the UK Independence Party until he left it after we withdrew from the European Union. And Reform is explicitly named after the Canadian party that helped demolish the Canadian Tories in the early 90s and is now cast along the same lines by Farage and the other major party figure, Richard Tice, which is to say their explicit aim, as they've put it now, is to replace the Tories as the major party of the centre-right, modelled on what happened in Canada in the early 90s. And they've managed, it's not really a party because it doesn't have any internal kind of democratic structure. It's, legally speaking, it's a private corporation with which is owned by the party leaders. And so that's worth drawing attention to. But Farage, having achieved 5 seats in Parliament unexpectedly, a bit lower than some of the more ambitious polling suggested, which suggested there might be as many as 13 seats for Reform, they've taken some of those seats. And it's still a significant breakthrough for a party that was so kind of unprofessional and unprepared that it was caught off guard by Rishi Sunak's announcement of a general election. Initially, Nigel Farage said he was going to go to the US because he wanted to intern with the Donald Trump campaign because the US is so much more important than Britain. And despite that, I mean, you think about that for somebody who claims kind of a patriotic national mantle to say that. He went back on it anyway, so he stood and he's finally won his seat on something like the eighth or ninth attempt to enter Parliament. He's finally won his parliamentary seat in an Essex constituency, which is the Jersey Shore equivalent for London as Jersey is for New York. And I don't say that disparagingly, only to give
I think it's the right description.
To give a sense for listeners around the world who might have a difficulty kind of locating the psychogeography of Essex, I guess. So Farage.
Was that the Rishi Sunak's intent? Because I mean, none of this election has been particularly surprising. It more or less conformed to the polls. You knew that the Conservatives would get turfed out, that they'd lose a huge number of seats, and that Labour would form the next government, more or less. And the surprising thing was actually when it would be announced, right? We didn't know when it would be announced. And was the surprise announcement designed not to outflank Labour, but to outflank Reform? I mean, it just occurred to me now. No?
Yeah, I don't think. Well, you know, I mean, who knows, right? I mean, I'm sure there's going to be these boring kind of memoirs or kind of hatchet job kind of reflections in the Mail on Sunday, our kind of middle brow kind of tabloid, where they'll be asking Rishi Sunak and his advisors as to, you know, when did he make the decision to call the early election that went so badly? Maybe George differs on this. I think, you know, I think it's a bit of two things. There was a calculation there, which is that things were only going to get worse for the Tories over the next few months in terms of because as the weather is warmer or relatively more stable, the migrant crossings in the Channel, which have been so problematic for undermining the Tory party's claim to actually be able to control Britain's borders and mass migration being so such a problem for the voters at large. So that wasn't going to go good. The risk of more economic turbulence also was to be avoided. And I think also partly kind of Rishi Sunak thinking of himself as some bold, it's like the thing, like what you'd be told to do at your Harvard, your kind of business management Harvard course, you know, like take your enemies by surprise. Sun Tzu says this up on the PowerPoint slide. And Rishi says, I'm going to do something nobody expects and outflank all of my opponents by calling an early general election, you know. And also, I think at the end
he speaks as well.
Pretty much almost there. Maybe at the end of the day, he knew he was going to lose, wanted to get it over with, and wanted to get on the plane to California. The guy's already got a green card. He's married to an Indian oligarch. And he wants to get into the venture capital game. You know, like this is a portfolio career. Being a prime minister of, the kind of what used to be a devolved territory of the European Union, with such little kind of concentrated power in the British state. He wants to be, you know, kind of in California, kind of, you know, designing pyjamas for cats or whatever the hell they do there.
Yeah, I think that was part of it. He wanted to pack up and get on. Silicon Valley was definitely calling. There was one bit of economic good news in the couple of days before he called the election. I mean, the only significant thing in retrospect about calling the election like that is there were, I guess it was a very, very minor scandal. There's always a scandal in every kind of election campaign. And this one, they weren't, you know, the hearts weren't really in it, in either the scandal mongers or the scandal makers, if that's what you do if you're accused of a scandal. There was some betting mainly on when would the election be. Some people bet against themselves, i.e. bet to lose when they were obviously going to. But that's pretty low stakes stuff.
Even by the sounds of British scandals, which tend to be pretty low key by kind of global standards, that's pretty small.
Yeah, we're not sending our best to the scandals, but no,
we should just go back though to Alex's question about the party.
Yeah, I was going to. Yeah.
Oh,
so
sorry.
Yeah, so I think, in fact, but more than the pull of the new parties, it was the push away from particularly the Tories. So I saw there was quite a few things flying around about, you know, what was the major reason that people voted Labour? And I saw one poll where it was 48% of Labour voters voted to get the Tories out. So the kind of, you know, it can't really be overstated how completely the Johnsonian kind of coalition that is, you know, the Tories completely imploded. And they've been doing it for a little while, but it's, I don't know if I've seen really that level of collapse and kind of, you know, just almost a decision not to try to maintain a coalition which had worked and had won in 2019, but instead to split that and to, you know, to basically get rid of some of the people who were instrumental to that. And, you know, I don't think there was any point really in the last 2-3 years when you would have sort of seen the Tories not losing, but yeah, they were just collapsing for quite a while and extremely unpopular by the time it came to voting day.
So, I mean, so what you're saying is that there's a push away from the Tories and to a certain extent from Labour. At the risk of asking a slightly awkward question, should Labour's share have been higher had it had a more attractive proposal? I mean, so I say it's an awkward question, but I mean, according to some baseline, which you might draw from the 2019 result, from the 2017 result, or from some sort of just general expectations about how British politics has worked in recent years, do you think that like Labour share should have been higher? Like that if Labour had a more attractive proposition, hypothetically, that it would have achieved a higher vote share, or do they kind of reach their ceiling and the real issue is just that votes went elsewhere?
So, I mean, votes very clearly went elsewhere. That's visible in the, so it's very clear the Tories lost, right? And this is the kind of, it's not an original observation. It's the conclusion of John Curtis, who's the big polling pathologist. Yeah, he's like Britain's kind of, at the moment, I mean, in the last few elections, he's come through as kind of Britain's biggest, kind of talking head sophologist. And, you know, he is good and reliable in terms of his analysis. And it's his conclusion is the Tories lost, essentially. So they lost votes. They lost some votes to Labour in the so-called Red Wall constituents, the people who broke from Labour in 2019 and put Johnson in power. And they lost some to Reform, which is the Farage's vehicle. And in fact, it seems essentially, if you wanted to kind of summarize the election as a whole, it's basically Farage or the Reform has let Labour in by taking votes away from the Tories. And so that is kind of, and this was, you know, what the Tories said to, this was the way they tried to kind of take away from the undercut the Reform arguments by saying, look, you're going to kind of have Labour hegemony for a generation if you don't give us your votes back. But the Farage and Reform said, we're not going to do that again, and we're going to destroy and replace or take over the Tory party. So it shows, I'm not fully convinced that they're up to the job, but the at least the kind of the stated willingness to destroy the existing political vehicle of the right is in marked contrast to the lack of any kind of similar force on the left. And that's also in marked kind of contrast to some of what's happening in Europe with the French elections that are actually being, the second round of the French parliamentary elections are being held as we're talking right now. If you had to summarize it, I think that would be it. It's Reform let Labour in by taking kind of disintegrating the Tory vote share, which means that they're in Parliament, but also they came second in many, many constituencies that Labour won, right? Which means effectively that the people who they're competing, the Labour are competing with in many constituencies, including Red Wall constituencies that they need in Britain's electoral geography to win a majority in British Parliament, they're competing with a Farageist, kind of mashup that isn't even really a party. So you have, I think, the British public withdrawing its support from the two wings through which it's given its political voice to in for the last century.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's one kind of bit from the Financial Times. They had a chart showing that enthusiasm for voting for Labour amongst Labour voters, among people who voted for Labour at the previous election in 2019, was way down, right? And that's relative to conservative voters who are actually like about the same, right? So the although the Conservatives lost, its own voters from the previous election are kind of like feeling whatever about it. You know, it's just kind of par for the course. Whereas it's really Labour where there was a real deficit of enthusiasm for it. And I guess that's one of the reasons why votes get splayed in all sorts of ways. We should talk a little bit about the left, which is, I guess, maybe not the Labour left, but, you know, the left which ends up voting. Maybe people who don't decide not to vote, right? Who might be regular Labour voters who decided not to just because they felt that Labour was going to win anyway and didn't bother turning up to the polls, which contributes obviously to this low kind of 60% turnout. But also voted for, where did those votes go? Green Party, notably?
Yeah, it's a good, if you had to choose two figures to kind of symbolize what's happened, you'd choose Owen Jones and Grace Dent. So Owen Jones, the former Guardian columnist, I should say, because he's obviously not a journalist. He still writes for them, but he's no longer employed by them. He's kind of a YouTube lefty now. But he kind of scrapped his Labour. He scrapped his Labour membership. And Grace Dent, who's part of the Navarra media stable, she's kind of plumped for the Greens. And Owen Jones has been bigging up the Greens as well. So you have like the radical left kind of the professional managerial class. I don't want to say the youth because they're clearly not. Sorry, Grace Blakely, not Grace Dent. George corrects me.
Do they stand for Parliament?
No. So they lent their support to the Greens and to independents. It's only to say that you do have a kind of a break on the left of the Labour Party, who have been battered and dismayed and outmaneuvered in the Labour Party by the dead-eyed bureaucrats of the Starmer hegemony, that they have finally left the Labour Party. And that's something, right? I mean, it's not insignificant because the slavish loyalty of the British left towards the Labour Party is a true kind of, it's a true study in the annals of sadomasochism. So that they've left them is something. Grace Blakely shared this meme of the Mean Girls from some stupid American TV show or movie.
No. It's the film Mean Girls with Lindsay Lohan, which is an excellent film.
Okay, I take your word for it. I've not seen it.
It is a good film.
Get in, loser. We're going to make trouble for the Labour Party. So if that meme is anything to go by, and I think it does represent how they've been kind of discussing it in public in more kind of sustained and considered fashion, then I think it shows they see the Greens as a kind of an external pressure group on the Labour Party, how they can hope to kind of, how they hope they can bring it back. They want nothing more. I mean, they want nothing more than to be invited back in, ultimately, I think, so they've kind of pitched their camp separately. But at the end of the day, like most of the British left, they can't imagine doing anything outside of the Labour Party. So,
although one, I do agree with your analysis, actually, Phil, but one counterpoint of this is, of course, Jeremy Corbyn, who is now an independent in North London. It was a close race, closer than I think many people thought it would be. But here is I think you don't want to misread the symbol too much, because I think ultimately Phil is right that the kind of it's a temporary decamping to the Greens, and maybe we'll see in the next election if that trend does continue of increasing support for the Greens from people who basically leaked out the left side of the Labour Party. But I think on the whole, Corbyn doesn't represent in his person of being an independent MP doesn't represent a likely trajectory from people who, with the younger kind of more enthusiastic Corbynistas in 2017, 2019. I think they're still wanting to try to get back into the Labour Party and to depose Starmer and the kind of the neo-Blairites or neo-Brownites or however they might be described. But of course, Starmer has now got points on the board and quite a considerable number. So within the kind of narrow electoral calculus of the internal to the Labour Party, maybe that's going to be a very difficult battle because
they're in the position basically that Reform and UKIP were to the Tory party, whereas Reform now is posing as the vehicle that's going to take over or destroy the Tory party in the attempt to take it over. They're not quite there yet. you know, the kind of the Greens, the Independent, the kind of radical left, but they're in the position that they UKIP was in kind of in mid or UKIP reform were kind of in mid kind of 2019. That's essentially where the kind of the green left is at the moment. And I mean, and it's entirely, you know, it's entirely consistent, right? Because it's essentially the radicalism with virtually no pretense to a working class base, because the Labour Party can still claim to be kind of interlocked with trade unions, whereas the Greens, obviously, they're all about social justice in a generic form.
Yeah, I mean, so it seems like the rump of the movement that coalesced around Jeremy Corbyn from 2015 on came together for one last ride to make sure that he didn't lose his seat in Parliament, and was successful in doing so. And
not quite, right? Because they got him in, but they boosted the Greens. So the Greens have the best ever result, 4 seats. Reform have 5 seats, but then there's also 5 independents. Right, who are essentially pro Gaza. You know, they stood on a Gaza platform in Muslim dominated urban districts or constituencies in the UK, and so that also is significant, because there are some seats where they took seats from the Labour Party, or they came very close to taking seats from the Labour Party, and the Labour Party know they need the Muslim vote, and so they're in. They're also feeling that pressure from that angle as well. So you have kind of fragmentation, right? For a first-past-the-post system, it's a remarkable fragmentation.
Well, yeah, I was going to recapitulate that point, I suppose, that the growth of, you know, high-percentage Muslim constituencies who are concerned about Gaza and voted on that basis, presumably, and were indeed successful in doing so, is I don't know how much to read into that as a phenomenon. It seems to be more a facet of that fragmentation, right? That you, with your own issues, whatever you might be, you can go off and pursue that because there's enough people flowing out of the two main parties that you have the capability of actually winning a majoritarian election in some certain constituencies.
But I mean, it wouldn't. I don't know what the highest number of independent MPs there's ever been. I probably should have looked this up, but you know, there weren't any in the last Parliament, and it just. I mean, I guess the idea of, you know, first past the post when you get results like this does seem to be somewhat ridiculous, but to defend the political principle behind it, at least to a certain extent, the idea is that you do have that accountability. Like you know who your MP is, and you as a voter have that constituency link. So if there is a sufficiently important local issue, then that is a way that you are able to depose your MP and have a different one. Yeah. So that kind of, as much as the fairness point, particularly given the current deconstitution of the two-party system, and the Lib Dems can get 500,000 fewer votes than Reform and get, like, you know, can't do it, 14 times as many seats.
I've got the numbers in front of me. So Reform got 14% of the vote and got 5 seats. The Liberal Democrats got 12% of the vote, so just a little bit less than the Reform, but won 72 seats. So yeah, that's stark.
That's what I just said, actually.
Oh yeah, but yeah, I was just saying the numbers, because you didn't have, yeah. But I guess this is the thing where if you want to challenge it, the first pass of the post system channels this into independence, because that's the only means you have of having some success, because you can you focus all your efforts on one constituency or maybe two constituencies to try to get someone elected, because getting 3% of the vote across the country or 5% of the vote might give you nothing. So obviously it does create its own dynamic.
Yeah, so this is the kind of, this is the cope that the Starmerite and the kind of centrist PMC are going for at the moment, it seems to me. So the name associated with this electoral strategy kind of ruthlessly focused not on, and in opposition to the Corbyn strategy, which was kind of piling up votes in safe districts, university towns, and solid kind of left-wing middle-class enclaves. They are very ruthlessly focused on winning seats in a way that would gain them the majority. And so the claim is like, we don't need to worry, you know, this is, it's cope, because the idea is that it's a deliberate strategy rather than a reflection of the deep unpopularity of Starmer, right? That we did this on purpose. And so, I mean, it's true, they did do it on purpose. It is kind of it's a strategy associated with Starmer's election advisor, McSweeney, and there's a great, listeners will find it in the show notes, there's a great profile of him that was done by Tom McTague and Unheard. But nonetheless, it's an adaptation to the profound withdrawal of support that the two main parties face. You know, it's kind of a cunning stratagem in the context of a collapse of support for the major parties, including Labour. So it's got them into power with a huge huge parliamentary majority. You mentioned the Sandcastle majority, Alex. That was James Medway, former advisor to the old Shadow Chancellor Corbyn's ally John McDonnell, and an ex-guest. In fact, he came on a while back in our early days. But he's coined this term "sandcastle majority." It looks very impressive, but you know, it only takes kind of the ebbing. It's produced by the ebbing of the tide, and when the tide returns in terms of mass kind of political interest and engagement, the sandcastle is very quickly washed away.
Yeah, indeed. So, I mean, just one last point, perhaps. This is your correlation does not imply causation moment, but maybe in this case it does. It's this chart that's gone round, and I will put in the show notes, someone tweeted it out, showing firstly in France, Phil's already made reference to the French parliamentary elections ongoing today as we record this on Sunday, the 7th of July. And we will have an episode on that, don't you worry, coming out very soon. It'll be out on Tuesday. Basically showing that that in France, the further you live from a train station, the more likely you are to vote for Marine Le Pen's Rassemblement National. And a similar sort of phenomenon in the UK, which suggests some geographical phenomenon going on, which is that if you drive to work, you are more likely to vote for reform. Now, how much store should we put in this? Is it meaningful at all? Or is it just one of those things?
A lot of store, I think. A lot of store. I mean, it's partly the phenomenon that Christophe Guilly captured in Twilight of the Elites, the French geographer. We haven't had him on, unfortunately, but we did talk about his book a while back, where he's talking about the transformation of these kind of metropolitan urban cores into kind of neo-feudal citadels, where they have a thin kind of layer of a service class serving metropolitan well-to-do middle classes who have assets locked up in property, and they force their working classes to the outside and then rigorously police their movement and entry into the core by putting up, you know, kind of congestion charges, various urban planning zones, and so on. And it is deeply, deeply resented on the periphery of those large urban centres. So this is like associated with green congestion charges. There's plenty of it in London, but also smaller cities. It's connected with the 15-minute city idea. And it is really unpopular, particularly among the working class voters that would have supported Brexit. So the correlation is entirely plausible to me and makes perfect intuitive sense if you know anything about British kind of politics over the last 10 years.
Yeah. Well, so the argument about France is that it's not just a question of mobility, but that the distance from a train station is stands for just generally being underserved by public services. So it's not just about your inability to get from place to place or get into the major urban cities, but that if you're far from a train station, it means you're far from a whole bunch of other services because it's a neglected small town. I don't know if the English case, because the English the example is a bit different. It's about driving.
It's definitely related, but it is slightly different. I think that the reality there's definitely a perception of war on motorists, particularly, as Phil was saying, people who are trying to get into cities. And that is where I think a lot of the, I was going to say the rubber hits the road. I mean, apposite perhaps in this context. So I think it is less about although they are related, it's less about being underserved by services. It's about having inconveniences to your commute, which can be rage inducing, and also I think a more general kind of sense that, you know, the Uniparty, or the, you know, both Labour and the Tories really don't kind of exist to to represent you, and in fact are actively hostile to the way that you need to get about for your job. And that is a that is a constituency who I think are politically independent from Labour and from the Tories. And that I think is one thing that came out of the 2019 election. And that's actually a kind of a one of the best things in some ways to have seen in the last two elections, is that I think taking your base for granted anymore is not really a very solid strategy in British politics. And that's very different to all the elections that I've seen before that, where it was really, okay, here's the people who they've got nowhere else to go, as Peter Mandelson famously said of some Labour supporters. Well, yeah, now they do. And actually they're going to do that. So that's a good sign.
So as to those Labour voters, 20% of the country voted for Labour amongst all voters, right? So their share of vote was, just checking the numbers here, vote share. I don't even have that. But anyway, they got 9.7 million votes.
34.
The vote share was 34%. Yeah, thank you. As a share of the entirety of the voting population of eligible voters, it was only 20%. So it's obviously not that many people, right? Who voted for Labour? Is there a way of simply characterizing it? Was it just kind of across class in different places? What was it like?
Yeah, who is your typical kind of Labour supporter in 2024? I mean, I guess who's the base of the Labour Party at the moment? I would say it's probably your state bureaucrats, your mango types, if you will, media, arts, academia, NGOs. This is your coinage, Alex. The bureaucracy and the PMC, and these people in society do have a considerable amount of influence. I think there's obviously, people who have voted Labour for a while, people who really do not like the Tories. But I think if you're talking about who does this party increasingly come to represent, and who is the base of the Labour Party in 2024, that's the way we'd see things going, with I guess some kind of exceptions around the edges of the younger PMC are more liable to kind of potentially lend their support to the Greens.
So I mean, a kind of the tip that, let me put it this way, probably a more typical Labour voter amongst the people, the masses, I don't know, not the PMC, right, would be typically, you'd say, maybe a care worker employed either directly by the local council or by some company which might be, or an NGO to which the service has been outsourced to, who would vote for Labour. Is that person still voting Labour, whether they live in London or they live in whatever, mid-sized town somewhere, you know?
Hard. I mean, I think, you know, it will obviously, they will have picked up a lot of, I don't doubt they'll have picked up a lot of kind of working class support, either through habit, as in as much as, you know, working class people voted, kind of folk memory and family loyalty, and also just frustration with dismal kind of 14 years of Tory government, right? I mean, no doubt about that. But I think in terms of its core base, in terms of the people who shape influence, who they pay attention to, who shape opinion, who shape influence, who influence, who are who matter to its kind of internal conversation, and who give it its esprit de corps, that's definitely the constituency that George said, you know, kind of middle class, the bureaucratic middle classes. And that's true even of Labour's so, you know, kind of Labour base, right? Because the decimation of private sector unions since the 1980s, ever since the 1980s, means that the major kind of unions that Labour depends on that are left are large public sector or public sector adjacent unions. So often, not exclusively, but often kind of white collar unions associated with the civil service or teachers, or nursing, for instance. And so, and the people who run those unions, right, they're not like the old kind of, they're not the old trade union bureaucracy. They're not the old kind of guys who would have come up from the shop floor, would have, you know, kind of rolled up their sleeves and perhaps, you know, kind of shocked you with their uncouthness and off-color jokes. The people who run...
Oh, how you yearn for that.
How the people who run these white collar unions, you know, they've got their PhDs in development economics from the School of Anti-Semitic Studies, or they've got their MA in Foucault theory and whatever. And, you know, I mean, they're entirely kind of, they're entirely of the PMC. So even my point is, like, even the trade unions, right, that are closest to the Labour Party are also, you know, they're politically integrated into the PMC as well. So it is the, by far and away, the dominant force of the Labour Party. And again, I mean, this is, if you don't believe us, you know, go read the Piketty on the Brahmins, because this is essentially what it is. The Labour Party is one of the clearest expressions of that tendency in Western states.
So what is, people aren't very excited about the Labour Party, obviously, and as I've already said, there's statistics to back up the fact that even Labour voters weren't very enthusiastic about it. What is Labour going to do in power? Presumably, it's not going to be something which is very popular or very interesting or both, hence people not really running to the polls to vote for them. So what is their program?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think in some ways, the election campaign was fought over the Labour Party's program being "We're not the Tories," which worked kind of well because everyone is like they're so unpopular after 14 years, and you're always going to have, I guess, that kind of negative incumbent effect after a relatively long period of rule. But I think in terms of what the Labour Party will do, there'll be some hope. I mean, some token nationalisations. But I would say the order of the day is going to be two things. One, authoritarian liberalism. So this idea of essentially trying to crack down on any sort of, not so much dissent, but, you know, social control through various kind of measures of illiberalism on the one hand. And on the other hand, I guess being a post-member state, this is a phrase that might need a little bit of explanation, but the fundamental mode of governance through the European Union that member states look to is essentially, of, you know, the political class evading responsibility. You can say, look at the constraints that we have out here in the, you know, the European Union. We can't really do what we want. We have you know, all of these problems, and instead, you know, we're gonna kind of just do what we can within very narrow narrow boundaries. So the question becomes, if you're not in the European Union anymore, how do you kind of replicate that? How do you continue to evade accountability? How do you sort of govern in this way which doesn't directly rely on popular legitimacy or having to represent constituents' interests or social interests at large? My prediction, sorry, a very long-winded way of saying it, but I do have a reason to say this, is that they will set up a load of quangos, essentially, and there'll be expert panels for this and independent reviews of that. And I think this is going to be the program. So there's not much of content in there, but in some ways the medium is the message, or the way of doing things is the signal or something.
So to concretize a bit more of what George was saying. So for instance, one of their great, you know, the Securenomics was the speech that the now Chancellor Rachel Reeves gave in Washington. So before she gave a speech in Britain about her economic vision, she, as a loyal kind of vassal of the, and paying tribute to the Imperial Center, she goes, delivers a speech in Washington. And she gives this idea of Securenomics. So they're trying to do the Bidenist kind of friendshoring thing. And the great vision to do this is this initiative called Great British Energy, right? However, it's not, you know, if you heard that, you might think, oh, they're going to build like all these new power stations in the wake of the energy crisis following the Ukraine war. We're going to be kind of self-sufficient in energy. And there's going to be like, I don't know, lots of new nuclear power stations with big union flags on the side or something. What it's going to be, in fact, is this kind of agency that will give tax relief and credits to various parts of Britain's kind of heavily regulated and decentralized and decrepit energy market, which was privatized over the course of the last 40 years. So again, it's a kind of, even the friendshoring is kind of timid, kind of limited, and it's all about manipulating and nudging and providing a new regulatory framework rather than actually doing things under the direct kind of authority of a minister who's responsible for energy. And that will be, I think, as they, you know, as they continue. So they're promising to devolve more powers. There's constitutional ideas, which have been kind of raised by the former Prime Minister, Gordon Brown, who's come up with a constitutional document to kind of disperse power from the centre. So I think in many ways, kind of strengthening all the problematic aspects of Britain's existence as a member state, deconcentrating public power rather than concentrating public power. So we'll continue that model of neoliberal governance, dispersing it into regions and into the constituent nations of the UK. And then there's also kind of empowering the Office for Budget Responsibility and empowering the agency which is tasked with monitoring parliamentarians. So, you know, kind of more human resources management of government, treating parliament as if it was, you know, kind of subordinate to the human resources bureaucracy of a large corporation rather than standing at the apex of the political system in the country. So neoliberal governance continues, but with a kind of a patina of this agenda for reshoring, essentially.
Yeah, so I mean Jesus fucking Christ, just like it, just hearing you go through that, Phil, I was thinking like all they would have to do is build some power plants and stop the water companies like directly dumping sewage into the rivers and the beaches, and that would be a step forward for Britain at this point in time.
Yeah, right?
it's so minimal,
and it's such an open goal, right?
Like yeah. I mean, as for listeners who are not aware, this is one of the, it was in some parts of the country, it was a big issue, with just like raw sewage being, I don't know, I'm laughing because it's really like third world shit, but like being dumped into rivers, being like, you see some really horrible pictures of like, you know, popular surfing beaches, and it's like, why is the water a bit brown? Oh, that's why. Anyway, sorry, Alex, you were going to
All of especially what Phil has been saying suggests that the Brexit period and particularly the kind of tacit democratizing tendencies that it expressed tacitly is over. But just before getting to that question,
not
I do want to
tacitly.
Ask
you did, not everyone was tacit in expressing these things.
I know. I'm sorry I didn't mention you specifically, but I mean,
I'm in this conversation.
The Brexit process
mate.
Involved a lot of people. Anyway, so I wanted to ask just before that, because Phil did mention Gordon Brown's constitutional proposals. Does the evident transformation of Britain into effectively a multi-party system, albeit within the container, its increasingly inadequate container of a first-past-the-post system, will that create a demand for some change to the Britain system, and where is that going to come from?
Yeah, well, so I think there'll be, you know, it'll come from the reforms and from the Greens, and it's still the kind of expressed position of the Liberal Democrats, who've done very well now in the Lib Dems.
I mean, so now does the Liberal Democrats, because they got a 12% vote share but loads of seats, surely yeah. Now they have a disincentive to push for
They do have
system.
A disincentive, but it's like, that's why I said it's one of their kind of most strongest kind of explicit commitments, right? So they're so you don't have an alliance for it there, because the Greens will refuse to cooperate with reform, even on kind of pure kind of pragmatic, you know, self-interest. Like you say, the Lib Dems now have a kind of an incentive to soft pedal the demand. That'll be difficult for them to sustain there. So there is kind of a latent shadow of what could be a movement for, you know, for proportional representation. And indeed, you know, it might kind of come depending on how the Tories fare through their selecting a new leader and how they reorganize themselves. But I think how far it's really the big push for it is the discrepancy. You have a government with such a tremendous kind of parliamentary power and such weak base in terms of popular legitimacy. And that simply you have now, you don't have any of the advantages that first past the post is supposed to convey, as George said. You know, that tight kind of link simply isn't there anymore between constituent and representative. So it seems to me the situation over the next 10 years or so is propitious for reform of the electoral system in the UK, for better or for worse. I think it could be a tremendous opportunity for democratic improvement if it came as part of a package of wider political reforms. But we'll see. But the opportunity for those who wish to seize it, I think the opportunity is there, though it won't be an easy slog, and it won't be overnight.
No, well put. Just one point to add, I guess, here is that there could be changes in the kind of the opposite direction, or not the opposite direction, but one thing which Labour may well be keen to do is to give votes to children, so to give votes to 16 and 17 year olds, which I think would be we're not here to kind of say what we think, we're here to analyze, but that would be, you know, a real undermining of the importance of the vote and the sort of, you know, the sort of thing that, you know, Labour might see this as a useful strategic move, but I think there's a whole load of problems with this. And actually, rather than me saying this, there's a very good article by Pete Ramsey on this, which we can link to in the show notes.
Okay.
So, in answer to your question, though, quickly, Alex, on Brexit Britain, it's not over, for the very specific reason. You know, I mean, there's many reasons you could point to, but one specific reason is the election itself, right? So the story of the 2019 election was the Red Wall emancipating itself from the Labour Party as a result of Brexit, and now the Red Wall has either gone to reform or gone to back to the Labour Party. Swing states, right? They put the Tories in power and now they've destroyed the Tories, and they could destroy Labour or at least slash the majority dramatically in the next election due at the end of the decade. So the point is, like, the electoral geography of Britain has been completely reorganized as a result of Brexit. And that's a direct result of Brexit. The fact that Starmer's won is a result of people either swinging away from the Tories or swinging back to Labour. And even more pointedly, the big kind of policy pronouncement, which was a tax, that the intention is to put a tax on Britain's private schools, where the middle classes kind of flee the dire state of public education in this country, and to use that tax, the proceeds of that tax, to improve public sector education. He could only do that outside of the European Union, because in the European Union, taxing private schools like that could easily be challenged and taken before the ECJ. So even the very modest revenue-raising move that Starmer has promised is a direct result of having Brexited from the European Union.
I mean, I take the point, though that seems rather like the pot has been stirred and the particles continue to move because of that stirring, but there's no ongoing kind of momentum being thrown into the system, which is to say, to rephrase the question that I asked earlier, there is no real kind of democratizing movement in terms of positive content from the Brexit moment now anymore, is there? Like the examples you gave are negative, right? It kind of tearing down the Tories, things being shaken up in some way, but in terms of there being a push
I know you hate Brexit, but it seems to me like a move towards PR.
Hatred for Brexit, yes, is proportional to your overclaiming for Brexit. The less you overclaim for Brexit, the more pro Brexit I am.
And yet I didn't overclaim for it, and there you still are.
So look, as the neutral here between the two ideologues, I mean,
yes, please step in, George.
Centrist George, please.
Yes, the potential destruction of the two-party system, like directly as a consequence of Brexit, that is, I would say that's kind of a big deal.
I'll take it, Alex.
I know you might be like, oh well, you know, in continental Europe they already have all of these kind of non-two-party systems and PR, and it's all, how does it work for them? But for, you know, it would be a big deal because it wasn't, you know, it wasn't working, and then we had Brexit, and now, you know, the world is an oyster, or something.
tasty oyster. Putting this in the opposite fashion, is there a movement for the UK to rejoin the EU in any substantial way? I mean, how does that look now?
Yeah, so there is. I mean, there always has been, and they certainly feel much more confident. You know, there's campaigning organizations associated with various kind of lunatics. There's the new European newspaper.
Well, if they're lunatics, clearly they're not very important, so therefore...
No, that's the terrible parlous state of our world, Alex. At the end of history, lunatics have far too much prominence. Some of them even have podcasts.
Never doubt that a small group of committed lunatics can change the world.
Yeah. So, I mean, there is like they feel very, I mean, you know, look, generally they feel energized by the fact they have a government of the kind of quangocracy, the PMC, the administrators, the bureaucrat, you know, they see that and they feel reassured and energized and confident. And anyone who is in Britain, you know, can kind of see and feel this, I think. Does that mean we'll rejoin the European Union? I don't think so. There, for the very simple reason that I don't think they would ever do anything so explicit as forcing us back in to, you know, Starmer. Somebody prefers kind of the grey paragraph C subclause 4 approach to politics. The idea of doing anything as decisive and clear as making a break to which would be so symbolically important and such a open up such a clear dividing line for an ideological battle he would avoid at all costs. It is likely there'll be less regulatory divergence and there'll be more kind of aligning with Europe, but that will be in keeping with the status quo because that's what Sunak did as well, the outgoing or the prime minister who's just lost. Except he couldn't make hay of it. Starmer will be able to make electoral hay of it. Sunak couldn't. But broadly, the policy was the same. It was accommodation and compromise in the name of a higher kind of European unity in order to maintain the NATO proxy war in Ukraine. So Starmer has every reason to kind of perpetuate that. However, that said, I think if there is some kind of economic crisis, you know, in a few years' time, the pressure to rejoin the single market, the customs union, that will be tremendous. And they might do it at that point without rejoining the European Union as kind of some, here's an economic solution to our problems. Mm. Let's align with Brussels and that will give us something. I mean, it won't, right? But it will be a political response.
I think, I think that's the... I don't think there would be a kind of from now a movement to rejoin the EU, but if there is a very serious, more likely economic than political crisis, but if there is a reason or something which is a burning platform which can be decisively, you know, solved by further evading political accountability by you know, anything short of rejoining the EU or maybe even up to that, that will be the situation in which it could happen. At the moment, it would require a kind of positive project for rejoining the EU, and that's not Starmer's, that's not the Labour Party's kind of mode of operation, and Starmer's personally as well. But you know, it could. I think I'm a little bit more worried about this than Phil probably sounds to be, because I think there is a very strong commitment to the ideals of the EU, not necessarily Europeanism, but the ideals of the EU within the governing class, the kind of all the labels that Phil used. That is precisely the kind of the kind of political strategy that serves that neoliberal mode of governance very well, i.e. The evasion of accountability in the EU. So yeah, I don't see it happening anytime soon, but you know, watch this space kind of thing.
So I mean, just to finally close off, there doesn't seem to be a huge amount of good news. There's not a lot to be excited about the British elections, I don't think. You know, as I say, even Labour's own voters are probably not terribly excited about Labour coming in with a sweeping majority. So that's the state of play. The one sort of more dynamic element of the system, or the kind of landscape of British politics, I guess, is reform, insofar as it's kind of a new entry. It has it came third in the elections and doesn't have that representation in Parliament. What is that dynamic going to be there? And I ask because one of the talking points that emerged immediately after the election results was, you know, Nigel Farage is going to be prime minister by 2029. I mean, that's one of those things thrown out there. I don't know how much credibility to lend that claim, but nevertheless, it does seem to be that the more dynamic aspect, at least of the opposition, would be Farage's reform. But maybe I'm I'm wrong.
Yeah, I think you are missing the good news story, and that's what we talked about before, which is that the two-party system in the UK.
Okay, but that's a negative. Crumbling. That's like you can look at the good part of the negative, but in terms of a positive.
Well, it creates the conditions for something.
I'm aware of this. We do the end of history.
Huh? You're too down
on it. We know this already. What I'm saying, it's just repeating a point that we've made for 7 years. You know, about the breakdown of the old system, and that's the positive to take from it. But actually speaking, my question is about whether Farage's reform is and how is going to emerge as the leader of the opposition de facto, if not de jure, etc.
Well, look, I mean, in parliamentary terms, no, right? They've got a huge kind of territory to traverse to get there. Politically on the ground, he's been kind of riding the crest of the wave of his five seats, and he's saying, they're going to professionalize the party, they're going to kind of democratize it, they're going to make all these reforms to its internal structure that they've not had the capacity to do. I'm not convinced any of it will amount to very much, just because it's very hard to kind of retool that kind of party. It's very cranky. It's kind of filled with all sorts of oddballs, eccentrics. And this isn't to disparage, because I can understand why, having been gaslit over the last few years so systematically, I can understand why all sorts of ordinary people who are taking an interest in public affairs are kind of going to kind of all sorts of odd ideas. But it's also got just old kind of 1980s old-fashioned racists kind of in the mangle too, who would have been voting for Thatcher back in the day, and now feel like reform is there, because it's still in some ways kind of its economic program, in as much as it has any kind of program at all, is a Thatcherite one. Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not going. It's not real. I mean, I don't doubt it's going to kind of gain more seats. If there was another election, it will establish kind of electoral bases of support and power bases and so on. But it's not going to take over the Tories. It's not going to displace them.
The only thing which is a reason for hope here is that if all of those, if reform space is sufficiently insistent that the democratization of the party is required, then this could have a dynamic whereby that unpopular and limiting kind of Thatcherite economic policy would be more in control of the members of the party, and that could change. And then you could see something which could, could actually have an effect of hopefully destroying the Tories. Who knows? Even moving leftward economically, destroying
are
Labour.
Are its members interested in anything other than low taxes? I mean,
definitely, yeah. The membership. I mean, they know they've got their contrast right between they've got Thatcherites, and then they've got working class people in red wall constituencies who want more state, right? And until they reconcile that in a kind of some kind of meaningful program, they're never going to get any further than they do at the moment. But are you asking if there's any reason for hope, Alex?
No, that's not what I'm asking. I was asking whether there's any kind of anything positive. I mean, as George said, there's no element in British politics who can even nationalize the water companies and stop them dumping pollution. So there's obviously nothing to be very positive about, right? So
there is. I think there is, because I think it is the case that and again, I think this is Brexit, but I mean, you want I think there are two things. So in podcast land, I think when we draw attention to trends, we have to make clear that these things unfold over the course, of years and years, because we're talking about, we're talking about electoral cycles every 5, 7, 6 years, right? So you're talking about decades around these processes unfold. So there isn't going to be, there's not going to be anything like, something that you could point to very clearly as a result of the disintegrative forces that we've identified at the end of history. We're not going to see the forces of disintegration are going to be the most powerful kind of overriding ones for a while yet. So that'd be one thing. The other thing is, is that there is nowhere for Starmer to hide. Right, he is under a kind of public and political intensity, and political intensity of pressure that would be much reduced were he in the European Union, because then it would be like, oh well, at the next council meeting of ministers with our partners, we're going to discuss a comprehensive plan to tackle this or that, and the political pressure would be diffused, the ball would be kicked down the road, it would be like, wait for this meeting, our partners in Europe, oh, we can't do that because of this, you know, we have to negotiate, discuss, and he's got an overwhelming parliamentary majority. No meaningful political opposition, a completely fragmented political opposition. And there's nobody above him, right? Nobody formally kind of, there's no formal kind of structures that cushion his decisions, or that could stand above him, or even kind of, you know, at his side, through which he has to parlay his decisions and come back to the British people. Right. And that is a direct consequence of Brexit again. And that seems to me positive. And perhaps there is no other place in the world that quite has, at least in the Western world, that has quite that spotlight effect as a result of the secession from the European Union that Britain has enjoyed.
That sounds like good news to me.
All right, so we'll leave that there. Thank you for joining us for this election roundup. More on European affairs very, very soon. The French election results, as we're recording this, the exit polls are coming in, showing that the new Popular Front has come in first, with Macron's grouping second and the Rassemblement National in third. But we're going to see that in much more detail tomorrow when I speak to Charles de Varenne, and that episode should hopefully come out straight away or by Tuesday. Certainly, other European things to look forward to for patrons only, we'll be discussing the film Siccità, or Dry, from 2022. It's a dystopian film about a three-year drought in Rome. Also, for patrons, in the Reading Club, we discussed Dimitri Fermin's Imitation Democracy. We actually just recorded that today. It'll be out very soon. Fascinating stuff about who's in the pay of Putin. Figure out which three of us. Place your bets now, and you can find out when you listen to that episode. We also have Catherine Liu back on to discuss academic populists, and my interview with Eva Illouz. I really enjoyed that, hugely enlightening about the development of emotional capitalism. All that to look forward to over the course of July. Well, that's it for now. Catch you later. Bye.